Well, for the most part, I trust the weather forecast. I know, the anecdotal evidence against such a thing is quite strong. We all have horror stories, don't we, of looking at the long-range forecast, planning a family day by the lake, maybe something even more important than that, and then waking up the day of to, what do we do now? Predicting the weather in a narrow time window is still very difficult. Forecasters are at the mercy, really, of the entire world system. Everything from ocean currents to jet streams to forest fires to volcanoes, even sometimes beyond the world system. The impact, for instance, of a severe solar storm. But they are getting much better with their sophisticated, computer-driven algorithms at predicting weather trends. You'll hear this. We're in for a warming or a cooling trend. You'll wonder what that means exactly. And so if I hear there's going to be a heat wave next week, hopefully not, but you get it, I've got no problem planning to golf earlier in the day on my day off. Generally, I'm not disappointed. Generally, I'm grateful that I can plan based on a future prognosis and not just based on what my eyeballs are presently taking in. Today, I want to suggest to you that in our second reading, Paul is offering us the grandest scale equivalent of such a forecast. The ultimate metaphysical divine trend, if that might be permitted. Today I'm building on what I talked about last week, where I claimed that Romans 8 is really the center of things, the center of the book, the center of the New Testament, the center of what God is doing in our lives and in the world. It's the center of understanding a new perspective and living from a new power, a rescue from the condemnation that comes when we apply band-aid solutions to our problems, our sin and guilt problems, our selfishness problem, our living with only ourselves in view problem. We are, Paul says, learning to breathe the Spirit, to cooperate with what the Spirit is doing in us, which is rooted in freedom from condemnation. I used the illustration of learning to breathe the fresh air of God in the midst of the low-lying and dangerous smoke. So, building on that now in the middle part of Romans 8, Paul wants to say that our foundation for believing this, for living this way, isn't just what we see right in front of us. Indeed, given the state of the world and sometimes of our lives, our communities, paying attention to only what is immediate would leave us in a quandary, unable to plan, to work towards cooperating more and more with the Spirit. Suffering is real, and we all experience it. But the trend, Paul says, the forecast, is not for long-term suffering. And I'm aware that some of you have been suffering for a very long time. But for full deliverance and healing, for a joy that is beyond astonishment. Therefore, it is right and good to plan your life with a view to what is coming. I was in a coffee shop Monday morning reading something, actually in preparation for this week's sermon, and a guy sat down opposite me. I could tell he was trying to read the title of the book I was reading. You know that look you get? Which was puzzling to him, and it was a puzzling title. The title of the book was Can These Bones Live? When he'd deciphered the title, with my help, we got into a conversation. Turns out he grew up in New York in a Episcopalian family and left the church when he was 16. I saw all I needed to see, he said. And from then went on to describe what he knew about church and why it wasn't for him. I listened to him, fascinated by what I was hearing and thinking about Paul, about how Paul nails it in the book of Romans. All of us are prone, myself included, to making snap or reactive judgments about the most important things in life. We can eyeball what's right in front of us. For example, a bad sermon, maybe this one, or a bad set of experiences, like the ones my new friend was telling me about, and conclude from that that God is irrelevant, that the church is just another social club, and a boring one at that. And so we can miss the center of things, the center that Paul is so passionately expounding here in this letter to this small emerging community that will one day change the world, much more than any of Caesar's decrees, which seemed so powerful at the time. My new friend is iconic, actually, of how Western civilization has been reacting to the church and God since the 18th century. Some of that reaction is completely understandable. I get it. I react as well. His reaction, though, is not just iconic of Western culture in the last few centuries, but of the entire arc, really, of Judeo-Christian history. And we see that in one of our foundational stories today, Jacob on the road. Jacob on the road, making his way, escaping home, the church, escaping the square life where he was expected to behave, follow the family religion, a religion he'd been told about since ever he could remember. I know, he was blessed by Isaac to go, but just maybe he was blessed to go in that kind of, well, I know you've got to leave, so rather than being bitter about it, here's my blessing, sort of. We have stories like that in our scriptures, right? The prodigal son. Remember what the father does? He gives the son the inheritance, which is a blessing. Using Paul's language, Jacob wasn't going to be in debt to anyone anymore except to himself. And since the 60s, that's generally how we've thought of things. The great irony, one I'm not sure has been adequately explored in the literature, but which I'll mention just now in passing, is that the more we seek to live not indebted to our past, religious and otherwise, the more our society has become actually in debt. I don't know, could be just a coincidence. Is the language of destruction in our gospel, which we react against, right? Speaking of reaction, related to those sorts of ironies? Maybe it is. We think we know a better way, and it turns out to be maybe more destructive than what we were in. But then Jacob, surprisingly, when he's least defensive and reactive, while he's sleeping, he meets God. Now, he's not just being told about God or about the great promises given to dad and granddad and mom and grandmom. Now, for the first time, he himself experiences the mysterium tremendum, the holy awe of God, of presence. Note that for Jacob, this is not comfortable. This is not, wow, isn't this cool? He's afraid. Sometimes people come to church, maybe experience liturgy for the first time, and say, well, that doesn't feel like home. That wasn't comfortable to me. And my question back is, should it? Should it all be comfortable? If God is other than you and me, should it always feel safe to be confronted by the awesomeness of being? The holy fount of existence? the reason why there is anything at all rather than nothing? There's a wondering for us as we try to help each other feel welcome, as we reach out to the stranger and to each other. What was it about Jesus' words that left people wanting more without those words being sappy or syrupy? You know, again, today's gospel is your example. Now, near the beginning of his journey, Jacob, whose name means to grasp the heel, named after how he was noted as grabbing Esau's heel as he came out of the birthing canal, is on a journey from conniving, away from reaction, towards becoming Israel, which means he who struggles with God and prevails. A person who won't settle for anything less than the future he perceives in this moment. A future that will come towards him in every present, that will define his moments and give him courage, telling him, God is not absent in your suffering, in your loneliness. God is present even when you are, in fact, traveling all alone. Life on God's terms, says Paul, is like the paradox Jacob experiences. There's suffering, there's disappointment, there's the question, wouldn't it just be easier to live like the rest of the folks, trying to get what's owed to me? But there's the other side, the little community at Rome, the small communities of faith in our me-first culture. You and you and you and me, we are Bethel, the house of God, the place of the mysterium tremendum, the holy awe. Far from being indebted to our old lives, already we're beginning to experience the down payment of our future inheritance. And so Paul holds together two things at the center that seem impossible to us. A super high idealism, if you will. A new identity, a new perspective, and a new power. Already we're breathing God. We're God's children. We're going to get an inheritance, a joy that literally, to paraphrase what he's talking about, the whole world is waiting for with such anticipation, it's standing on tiptoe, waiting for what's happening in us. And a realism. We often feel sterile and barren in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts, our souls. We suffer, we groan alongside of everything else that is growing. And so Paul is drawing on his Jewish heritage. He's drawing on what it means to live by faith. We experience both realities together as Jacob did, but the power of the future is already here in the presence of the Spirit, and it's gradually working, wooing, changing us and the world. If we plan to live by what we see right in front of us right now, we'll leave, we'll pack it in, we'll flit from one thing to another, always reacting, always unsatisfied. But if we live from God's forecast, not only will we make wise plans, already we'll begin to taste of what's coming. We'll be able to get on with what's coming. So where in your life are you reacting? Where in your life are you living as if the only thing that is real is what's right in front of you? Do you find yourself walking away from what is your rightful inheritance because of what you might be experiencing right now? Faith is enlarged, Paul says, if we patiently wait. A pregnant mother who patiently waits, Paul says, doesn't diminish but gets larger. So you and I will be the bearers of new life if we wait in faith. And so in your faith, I would encourage a practice of reading, of contemplating passages like this. It will stir you, I promise you, lead you to prayer, and give you fresh hope. Most Anglicans that I know, including myself, could use a fresh and regular dose of this kind of gospel idealism. God's forecast is trustworthy. We've been told what's coming. Already we're experiencing the first rays of sunshine penetrating the dark smog. The trend is healing of all sorts, forgiveness and new life. Plan accordingly.